Let's return to Shank Talk Worldwide with Peter Shank fighting the war of perception 5 days a week. Only on the Voice of Reason. Dare to know.
Mark, you've written an article entitled How Relevant is Holocaust Revisionism?
Right.
And you got a lot of flack for this article, and I'm just going to jump right in and ask you the $64 million question. And that is, are you changing your position on the Holocaust? Are you somehow running away now from Holocaust revisionism?
Well, the article got a lot of attention. It's been widely discussed. It was the basis for an article that appeared in the Jewish weekly newspaper, The Forward, published in New York. And the article that appeared in The Forward and many of the comments about what I wrote have been inaccurate and misleading. And many of the people who have criticized me for writing that article are obviously responding not to what I wrote, but to what others have written about the article and about me. So I really welcome and appreciate this opportunity to clarify some things. The main point is that nothing has changed. I haven't changed my view about the Holocaust. I haven't made any new position, despite what some people say. This doesn't represent a new policy for the IHR. The points that I made in that article, How Relevant is Holocaust Revisionism, are points I've made many times over the years. I made them both publicly and privately. In 2002, at an IHR conference, I devoted a whole talk to just this very point and made many of the very same points at that conference that I did in this recent article. And those people who claim that this is a new position policy just simply haven't been paying attention. The policy and the work of the IHR in the last 5, 7, 10 years has been entirely consistent with what I wrote in that article. I don't take back anything that I've written or said about the Holocaust. But the point of my article was to try to clarify the relationship between Holocaust revisionism and what some people say the purpose of Holocaust revisionism should be. I've been watching how some Holocaust revisionists have been saying that Holocaust revisionism is important because it's a way to break Israel's power, or because it's a way to liberate Palestine, or for other reasons. And I tried to lay out in the article I wrote why I don't think that's a very effective way to achieve those ends. But I'm not saying that Holocaust revisionism is at all unimportant or irrelevant. To the contrary, in the article, I explicitly, pointedly said Holocaust revisionism is important, and it's done a great service in helping to provide a more accurate and complete understanding of what happened in Europe as part of the so-called final solution. And I've done a great deal over the years to help that process myself. few Americans have written more or said more or discussed more or done more to try to encourage Holocaust revisionism and have spoken out about on that subject as much as I have. I testified for 5 days in the second Zindel trial in 1988 as a recognized expert witness on the Holocaust issue and the Final Solution. I have helped to publish many books and articles over the years about this issue by many writers. So all of these are things that I have done, and I don't regret doing that. But it's also important to understand, I think, and take and soberly and realistically assess just what's going on and why Holocaust what the role of Holocaust revisionism is and should be. The fact is that after some 30 years of work in this area, Holocaust revisionism has had only minimal impact in society at large. I don't know of any prominent American historian who says that he's a Holocaust revisionist. It's had very little impact. It's been very hard, difficult in accepting this in society at large. Now, there's reasons for this, and I lay those out in the article. And, of course, the obvious reason is that in many countries, it's illegal even to express any kind of doubt or any kind of questioning of the familiar and traditional Holocaust narrative. And even in countries where it's not illegal, those who express any doubt about the standard 6 million story have their careers ruined, their lives are ruined, and there's a heavy penalty to pay in our society for expressing any kind of doubt or deviation or dissent from the standard Holocaust story. So there's reasons for it. But there's another reason that I tried to lay out in the article, why it's difficult to get many people to accept the Holocaust revisionist view of this chapter of history. And that is that it's undeniable and unquestionable that Europe's Jews did suffer a catastrophe during World War II. German policy during the war was especially harsh in its treatment of European Jews. And as I point out in the article, Jews were rounded up in Germany and in Holland and in many other countries. They were transported across Europe, forced into crowded ghettos, into concentration camps. Many Jews died in these camps. And as I say, millions of Jews lost their lives. Jewish communities in Poland and Netherlands and Germany and so forth were wiped out. They were gone at the end of the war. So there's no question but that Europe's Jews suffered a catastrophe during World War II. Now, the extent of this catastrophe and the nature of it are still questions that revisionists, including myself, and mainstream historians disagree about. But because there's no question that there was a catastrophe endured by Europe's Jews during World War II, it's very difficult to persuade most people that the Holocaust is either a big lie or a big hoax, because the catastrophe was large enough that disputing numbers and methods and how people died comes across to most people as quibbling, really. So it's very difficult to be effective in persuading people that the Holocaust is a big hoax when, for most people, the catastrophe was undeniably great enough that it's hard to dispute that.
Now, Mark, you've covered a lot of ground here. I'd like to backtrack just a bit because I want to clarify a few things. In your article, you asked the question, how relevant is Holocaust revisionism? That almost alludes to the fact that you don't believe it is relevant.
Well,
but you do, but you did clear that up, and you did say you do believe it's relevant. But let me just add a question to that. Many people believe that the Holocaust is relevant and important in destroying the Zionist grip on Israel, and of course the basically the whole PR image of the Jewish state is based on the Holocaust. Right. I would even add that all of our white guilt that we feel today is based in the Holocaust and the Nuremberg trials. That's where you can find the origin of the white guilt that we feel throughout the West. Now, you disagree with that. Why do you disagree with the common wisdom, or let's say the conventional wisdom, that we've got to destroy the Holocaust myth to destroy Zionism? Why do you disagree with that?
Well, I lay out the reasons for that in my article, but the basic reason is that the huge Holocaust propaganda campaign, which we're all familiar with, and this campaign manifests itself in motion pictures, in books, in obligatory classroom courses, in a U.S. government agency called the United States Holocaust Memorial Council, the museums, Holocaust museums all across the United States, and so forth. This enormous campaign that indoctrinates and pushes the Holocaust on the American public is, as I believe and as I explain in the article, not a source of Israeli or Zionist power or Jewish Zionist power. It's an expression of that power. And that's an important distinction to be made. Even if the Holocaust story were shown to be an exaggeration or untrue, Israeli power and the power of the organized Jewish community would still be very, very great. The proof of that is that even in the 1940s, when the State of Israel was founded, the Holocaust did not play anything like the role in our society as a propaganda tool as it does today. The rise of Holocaust remembrance and of the Holocaust campaign in our society has taken place as along with and as an expression of the rise of Jewish power in our society culturally. Zionism and the power of the organized Jewish community was profound and great even before Israel was founded as a state. That is, even before World War II, even before the Holocaust, you could say. And the idea that Israel or Jewish Zionist power would fall apart or be destroyed if one can show that the number of Jews who died in World War II was 1 million rather than 6 million, I think is an illusion. It's not realistic. It's not true. Moreover, it's almost impossible to effectively show that the Holocaust story is untrue when the catastrophe that Europe's Jews endured during World War II was so great that this making a distinction between whether somebody died of starvation in a camp or whether that person was killed in a gas chamber is almost an academic one for most people.
This is a very, very sensitive topic, and I've argued this point with many people, and I want to let you know that your position regarding the Holocaust is very similar to that of Professor Kevin MacDonald. He believes the topic of the Holocaust is a non-starter as well, with regards to fighting Zionism. In my opinion, I agree with both of you. I think the topic is a non-starter. I do think Holocaust revisionism, historical revisionism for that matter, is very, very important. But I don't see the linkage between the Holocaust myth and Zionist power. However, what I see is a way to show the Orwellian style censorship that we are experiencing in the various Western countries with regards to Holocaust investigation. I believe we should be emphasizing the affront to free speech and historical research when the ADL goes around the world trying to implement Holocaust denial laws. This, to me, should be the focal point, not the actual Holocaust itself, but the affront to freedom of speech and historical research. This should be the angle, in my opinion.
Well, I essentially agree with you. The Holocaust Remembrance Campaign in our society has the role it does and plays the role it does as an expression of this power, the power of the organized Jewish community in America, of the pro-Israel lobby, whatever you want to call it. This is a point that needs to be stressed and emphasized, that it wasn't until the late 1970s and the early 1980s, for example, that American encyclopedias even had an entry for the Holocaust. People who are older or people who care about these things know that the Holocaust didn't play anything like the role it does today in the United States until the late 1970s and the early 1980s. And this was done as a part of a concerted campaign by the Jewish community in America and by the State of Israel. Holocaust denial laws, although they existed in a form, in a certain way, even after World War II, were not explicitly put into effect to deny, making it a crime to deny the Holocaust until the 1970s. And the first country to enact such a law was Israel, and the World Jewish Congress organized a campaign to promote and impose those laws in other European countries, and this was done. But that's exactly right. I think the important thing is to understand that the Holocaust campaign, which effectively says that the deaths of Jews are more tragic or a greater tragedy than the deaths of non-Jews, this entire campaign is an expression of this great power. And there are other manifestations of this power in our foreign policy, in our cultural life, and so forth. And so I think you and I, based on what you said, Kevin MacDonald, Professor MacDonald, all are in agreement on this point.
When you discuss this with the average person and you declare that the Holocaust never happened, that it was a myth, 6 million Jews didn't die in World War II, most people, their eyes kind of glaze over. They just, they just turn off. It's almost like Clockwork Orange, where they condition you with these movies and these horrendous movies of emaciated Jews and camps and dead bodies. And they do this to young children in school. So by the time they become teenagers and adults, when you discuss the Holocaust, and if you don't agree with the 6 million number, you immediately get a negative reaction. On the other hand, if you discuss the violation of freedom of speech and the censorship laws that revolve around this issue, that to me, in my opinion, you'd find a much more receptive audience.
Right. I think that's quite true. And as part of what you're saying, I think that it's clear that younger people regard what happened in World War II as much more distant in history than do people who lived through it, obviously. For younger people, World War II and the Holocaust is a part of a distant, increasingly distant history. It's less vivid, less real, and has less relevance in their outlook on the world than do more recent events. My goodness, I mean, for high school kids today, the Vietnam War took place a long, long time ago as far as they're concerned. Now, that's not to say that the Holocaust isn't hammered away and emphasized in our society. Over the Christmas season, there were 5 or 6 Holocaust-related motion pictures launched, and they're still playing in theaters all across the United States and around the world. There's no question but that the Jewish community in America still pushes and tries to keep pushing this whole campaign for obvious reasons, for its own reasons, in our society. But the effect on younger people especially is, I think, obviously less and less with the passage of time.
Recently, Bishop Richard Williamson came out and said he did not believe that 6 million Jews died in gas chambers. Now, he was very specific with that. He was referring to gas chambers and that they couldn't possibly exist. What is your opinion on Bishop Williamson's comments?
You know, it's amazing that he should be criticized in the way he is. The hysteria over what Bishop Williams, Williamson said is just fantastic. If he expresses dissident or unusual views about any other chapter of history, nobody seems to care. In fact, nobody believes that anything like 6 million Jews died in gas chambers. The standard Holocaust story is that some millions or whatever died in gas chambers and others died or perished in other ways. But not even the most fanatic Holocaust historian or supporter of the Holocaust story claims that 6 million Jews were gassed in gas chambers or killed in gas chambers. But for making the remarks that he did, Williamson has just been excoriated and criticized. Bishop Williamson has a lot of unusual views, but the only one that people seem to be all angry about are his views about the Holocaust, and that just shows the way that the Holocaust in our society has taken on this almost sanctified, iconic status, which is wrong and stupid, really. But and also he made a number of other observations that I think are quite valid, and he made some very good points. But at the same time, he's not a historian, so he's not able to defend himself probably as well as a lot of other people. He has to refer to others.
What about this this news story today? It seems that the Chancellor of Germany, Merkel, is now asking the Pope to clarify his position on the Holocaust.
Yeah, well, this is the real problem for Germany, because the remarks of Bishop Williamson are not merely dissident remarks. As far as the German government is concerned, they're criminal remarks. The fact that the bishop made these remarks and that they're on YouTube makes him now susceptible to being prosecuted by German authorities for a crime, even though he didn't make these remarks in Germany. The German government has already shown that it believes it has the right to prosecute people and punish people for making dissident remarks about the Holocaust, no matter where they make them anywhere in the world. This is fantastic. For example, last year, Frederick Tobin, who's a citizen of Australia, was arrested in Britain when he was changing airplanes. He was on an airplane in a London airport, and the German authorities wanted him taken to Germany for remarks that he had on a website in Australia. This is fantastic. It's not even in Germany. But the German government regards revisionist or dissident views about the Holocaust to be a crime no matter where in the world they're committed. So the German chancellor, in a sense, has to demand some sort of punishment or some sort of rebuke of the bishop for these remarks, because if she doesn't, the German government will not have the authority or the right, at least the moral right, to prosecute other people for making similar remarks. It can't very well say that it's all right or permissible for the bishop to make those kinds of statements, but not for Australians or Germans or anybody else to make them.
Which illustrates my point that we need to put these laws in the light of day to show the hypocrisy, the contradiction, the Orwellian big brother aspect of these various Holocaust denial laws. These are completely against the spirit of what anybody would consider human rights or God-given rights, freedom of speech, so on and so forth. And this is exactly what I'm pointing out. We could attack this from this angle, and it would be very effective, versus hammering away at the Holocaust didn't exist, 6 million Jews didn't die. That's not going to work. That's a non-starter, in my opinion.
Well, I agree that the real point for people is that now men and others or women are being fined or imprisoned for making remarks about one chapter of history that are considered criminal, when one can make dissident and even outrageous statements about any other chapter of history without any punishment. The reason that these laws exist, the reason that there's this double standard, the reason there's this focus on the Holocaust is because the organized Jewish community has an interest in this and demands that dissident views about a chapter of history that's important to the Jewish community be punished. And Germany is very vulnerable in that way because the guilt campaign directed at Germany is more effective than any other, than directed at any other country. Although the Jewish community and the World Jewish Congress have tried to impose the same guilt grip on other countries as well.
We'll be right back after a brief intermission. Don't go away, because there is more on Shank Talk Worldwide with your host Peter Shank on the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network.
The Voice of Reason Radio.
What is the role of your institute? What is the primary function, and when did the institute begin?
Well, that in the whole fallout of the articles that I posted last month, there's a lot of the discussion has gone beyond what I wrote to be a discussion about, well, what's the IHR doing and what's Mark Weber doing? It's gotten into an emphasis about what the IHR is about and what it's supposed to be doing. The people who have been criticizing the article and me seem to think that this institute should be called the Institute for Holocaust Review instead of the Institute for Historical Review. In fact, over the years, and from the very beginning, the Institute for Historical Review has dealt with a whole range of historical issues. But I've found that with the passage of time, the interest in the Holocaust has become less important to people, and the interest in other issues, such as the Middle East situation, the power of the organized Jewish community in America, and so forth, has become much, much greater. Those issues are issues of people, millions of people all around the world are really interested in. And I can't force people to buy the books that we offer and the discs and tapes and flyers that we distribute, force them to buy those when they're not interested or less interested than they used to be. And the fact is that very little of in the way of new research or new scholarship about the Holocaust from a revisionist point of view has been produced in the last 10 years. Very little. And the books and the tapes and the discs that we offer for sale have been largely sold to those people who are interested, and the sales of those items to people who are new to the subject is really very small. So it's just a fact. But the Institute for Historical Review has to be pertinent and relevant in the world in which we live. Historical revisionism in the 1920s was focused on debunking the official Victor Powers view of the origins of World War I. In the 1940s and 50s and 60s, the focus of historical revisionism was largely on the origins and the course of World War II. In the 1980s, you could say, or 1970s, a big emphasis was on the Holocaust. But the focus of the Institute for Historical Review and the focus of historical revisionism in this new decade of a new century cannot be the same focus of historical revisionism as it was in the 1920s or the 1960s or the 1980s. We try to emphasize history and as it's relevant to what's going on in the world today. And World War One and its origins are a lot less relevant to the world today than they were in the 1920s. And World War II and its origins are less relevant than they were in the 1960s. And the IHR, to survive and to be effective and to be pertinent, has to deal with historical issues that have pertinence and relevance in the real world that we live in now.
Mark, you're in the middle of all of the historical revisionism, and what do you think happened if these 6 million Jews dead in the Holocaust is not accurate, if it's a myth? What do you think happened to the Jews during World War II? Bishop Williamson suggests that about 200 to 300,000 died in World War II. Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of what you think happened to the Jews in Europe during World War II?
Well, Bishop Williamson didn't say 200 to 300,000 Jews died in World War II. He said he thought that's how many died in camps. Now, I think the number is larger than that. I think the number of Jews who lost their lives in World War II as direct or indirect victims or of German policy or the policy of other countries in Europe is larger than that. And so Bishop Williamson is only, in a sense, telling part of the story. For example, many Jews were shot and killed in occupied Poland, Ukraine, and Belarus and Lithuania during World War II. They weren't ever put into camps. And Bishop Williamson doesn't even deal with that, and many others don't really deal with that, too. But there's no question but that the policy toward the Jews was a very harsh one, and Jews were singled out for especially harsh treatment. And the number of Jews who died as direct and indirect victims of German policy and of the policy of the other Axis governments during the Second World War is certainly more than 2 million, but it's less than 6 million. Now, this is a very confusing and confused chapter of history, and it's hard to come to exact numbers. But it's worth remembering that even prominent Jewish Holocaust historians have provided estimates of the number of Jewish dead during World War II lower than 6 million. Gerald Reitlinger, who was a Jewish historian who wrote the book The Final Solution in the 1960s, he estimates the number of Jews who died of all causes in World War II is something like 4 million. Raoul Hilberg, who was a very prominent Jewish Holocaust historian and wrote a famous book entitled The Destruction of the European Jews, he estimates that 5.1 million Jews lost their lives during World War II. Now, that's not killed, that's died during World War II. But in spite of this, we're told over and over that 6 million Jews were murdered during World War II. Well, that's not true. And if the Holocaust is defined as the killing of 6 million Jews in World War II, European Jews in World War II, then it's not true. It's false. But it's very difficult to have any kind of open discussion of this because, especially for Jews, the whole Holocaust issue is so emotional, so emotion-laden, that anyone who tries to discuss it in any sort of calm or objective way is immediately shouted down and in some countries thrown into jail or silenced in other judicial ways.
This is what's amazing about the Holocaust denial laws. If you were to bring those books into a court of law, the books you refer to written by Jewish authors that have a lower number than 6 million, you would still go to jail for Holocaust denial because the truth is no defense in Holocaust denial cases.
Right. I testified twice in human rights tribunal hearings in Canada when Ernst Zundel was being tried by these tribunals or before these commissions. And in those cases, the presiding commissioner stated explicitly that truth is no defense. It didn't matter whether what Ernst Zundel had said was in fact true, or anybody else in these cases, any defendant in these cases, what he or she said was true. They're only concerned of whether those remarks are considered offensive. Well, That's an outrageous thing, because lots of people are offended by lots of things that are said in our society and other societies. But it seems that only one group of people are successful in dragging people before tribunals and having them punished for remarks that are considered offensive. In Europe, for example, most Europeans thought it was defensible to publish cartoons that were offensive to Muslims. Muslims are outraged when a Danish newspaper and then some other newspapers publish cartoons that mocked or made fun of Islam, of Muslims. And that's considered okay. But cartoons or other remarks and other writings that are considered offensive to Jews are criminal in European countries. And this double standard is one that the whole world really understands, and it's an embarrassment. It's an obvious double standard.
I would wager, though, that most people in America and Canada are not aware of this double standard. They don't understand what these Holocaust denial laws are about. They just hear the news, the man is a Holocaust denier. They associate the term Holocaust denier with racist. And today in our society, being a racist is the worst thing you possibly could be. You can be a liar or a rapist, a child molester. That's okay as long as you're not a racist.
Yeah, well, a person can be a supporter of Mao Zedong or communism. He can be hostile to religion, whether Christianity or Islam or any other religion. He can say all sorts of outrageous things, and that's considered all right. But Holocaust denial has gotten this status in our society that it's an acceptable thought crime. And George Orwell would be appalled at this. But I'm gratified, I'm encouraged by the fact that many people, most people around the world, understand the injustice here. When David Irving was arrested in Austria in 2005 and sentenced by a court in Vienna to prison for having made some Holocaust revisionist remarks 16 years earlier, there was a flood of editorial comment and opinion pieces all over the world about the arrest of David Irving. Overwhelmingly, and I mean really overwhelmingly, newspapers and commentators around the world were critical of the law in Austria under which David Irving was sentenced and put in jail, and were critical of the laws that exist in other countries making so-called Holocaust denial a crime. So it's gratifying to see that around the world there's an understanding of this double standard. And it makes a mockery of the claims by Germany and other countries to support free speech and democracy when this principle is so blatantly violated when it comes to offending Jewish community sensitivities and sensibilities.
I just received another news article regarding this topic, and it seems that a prominent priest with the Society of St. Pius X, which was Richard Williamson's, I think that was his denomination, or the group he belonged to, this priest, Father Floriano Abramowitz, evidently is a Jew that converted to the Catholic religion, and he's come out today and said that the Jewish Holocaust has been exalted over what he called other genocides, such as the Allied bombing of German cities and the Israeli occupation of the Gaza Strip. And this priest is also part Jewish, as I said. It seems like the lid is coming off of this, so to speak.
Right. Yeah, we posted an item on our website as well about this. And this is also obvious. There's this immense double standard, which in effect says that the deaths of Jews are more tragic and more to be mourned than the deaths of non-Jews. This is offensive. It's insulting. It's really outrageous. And this double standard is enshrined in law. The president of Iran also just the other day made similar remarks in that He says that he was talking about the suppression of free speech and free inquiry on the Holocaust issue in European countries. And he says that this is done to promote the political interests of European states. And there's more and more awareness of this, and it's gratifying to see there's more and more cracks in the dike here.
What do you think is the motive behind this character assassination of yourself? I mean, I believe this is nothing more than character assassination. I read your article. I didn't see what the big hubbub was about. The article was very well written. It made sense. It was logical. And yet, you've been assassinated, in my opinion. At least your character has. Who do you think is behind this, or what is the motive?
Well, it's hard to know about people's motive. I try not to question motives very much. People often don't know their own motives and why they do things. But I think part of the problem is that for some people, Holocaust revisionism is very important emotionally, and that anything that seems to weaken that, especially from someone like myself, who's played a role in this, people are afraid of that. It looks like it's bad. I'm not sure, but I've been astonished at the irrational, hysterical nature of some of the criticisms that have been made of me for having written this article. At the same time, I've gotten a lot of support for writing the article, too. The critics have been a lot louder and a lot more vocal than the supporters. But a lot of very influential, astute, seasoned writers and others have expressed support to me for having written the article. And quite a few people have said someone should have written the article, and they're very happy that I wrote it. Some people have even said, I'm so glad you wrote the article. I'm making a new donation to the Institute for Historical Review. But the critics of the article and of me are really a small group of within a kind of self-absorbed group. One of the disadvantages about the internet, I think, is that it encourages a lot of self-important people to voice empty opinions about everything. And people who are critical and loud enjoy doing that. But it's self-indulgence. It doesn't do any real good. It's just showing off. And a lot of this criticism is coming from a very, very small group of people who don't support the IHR anyway, and who are even writing under pen names.
What's interesting is that you have a group of people that hate Jews so much that it borders on a psychosis, and I think it kind of clouds their judgment and their thinking. On the other hand, you have other people out there like the Kevin McDonalds, like the Mark Webbers, and like the Peter Shanks, who are saying, let's look at this logically, rationally, and let's come up with what is the, let's use all the facts to find the truth. That doesn't matter where the cards fall, let's just find out what the truth really is. It doesn't matter if this hurts Israel or if it helps Israel, let's find out what the truth is. That should be the mission of the IHR, and I believe that's what it is. Would that be correct?
Yes. I mean, I don't wish harm to anyone based upon his ancestry or the accident of his birth. I am concerned, and I've written a lot and spoken a lot about the harmful effects of this, what I call Jewish Zionist power. You can call it the Israel lobby, you can call it other things. There's different names for it. But this power has real consequences and harmful consequences, I think, for America and the world. But there are some people who are so angry and so hateful that there's no villainy, nothing, they don't see the evil hand of Jews behind. So they, a lot of them are just unhinged when it comes to, I think, reality. If a bomb goes off in Mumbai, killing people, apparently it was carried out by Muslim terrorists in Mumbai. I'm not an expert on it, but there are plenty of people who immediately say that it must have been carried out by the Mossad, by the Israeli secret service. Well, maybe, but the quickness that some people have to blame Israel for absolutely everything bad that's going on is just astonishing and unhinged. It's irrational.
And yet, these are the individuals that get paraded across the national media whenever they want to show how irrational historical revisionism really is. This seems to work to really smear historical revisionism or white nationalism or whatever the cause may be. These what I call maniacs are waiting in the wings for CNN and CBS to give them a phone call.
Right. I've been very disappointed at how some people are so quick to assume the worst motives in other people. They're quick to blame. They think that cynicism is a form of wisdom. It's almost as if there's a contest among some people. They'll say, well, Israel or whatever did this, and somebody else says, no, they did this, and I can top that with some new example. But cynicism is not a substitute for wisdom, and it's important that, especially for the Institute for Historical Review, because we have to, and I have to act in a public way. I have to be accountable for what I say. I have to be careful that I don't say things that are unfounded or exaggerated, because I'll be held to account for it. But on the other hand, there's plenty of people writing on some of these chat groups anonymously who have absolutely no accountability whatsoever. And I think it's great fun to criticize others and to say the most exaggerated and unfair things.
Yeah, I heard a good one the other day, that the Pope is Jewish because he wears a yarmulke.
What do you do with something like that? It's so stupid.
It's unbelievable. I mean, they're going on and on about it for 15, 20 minutes, how the Pope is Jewish because he wears a yarmulke, and how the Catholics are Jewish because they wear yarmulkes.
Well, there's many examples of that. You and I talked once about the 9/11 people. I mean, I'm no expert in it, but I've been dismayed about how many people who are involved in this thing seem not to care at all about the larger reality that millions of people around the world are so furious and so outraged at U.S. policy in the Middle East that they're willing to kill and die to make clear their opposition and their hatred of these policies. And sure, it may be that this or that terrorist action was actually carried out, isn't what it seems, and wasn't carried out by Muslims, but there's no question that a lot of Muslims and even non-Muslims are just furious at what the United States and Israel are doing, and they're willing to kill and die for that purpose. And this is the larger reality that's going on in the world. There's a growing worldwide sense of outrage about what Israel is doing and about America's support for Israel. And I've written and I've tried to emphasize that the United States almost certainly would not have attacked Iraq if the United States didn't have this perverse alliance with Israel, and that Israel's enemies are supposed to automatically be America's enemies. This is all very dangerous, and this should be understood that people all around the world are outraged by this.
Moving along, what is the future of the IHR? What do you what is the future mission of the Institute for Historical Review?
I laid out in this response to the critics of my February 7th article a listing of what I think the IHR, emphasizing the IHR's track record. And I am proud of what the IHR has achieved. I'm proud of our resolve and the impact we have around the world. Just 2 or 3 days ago, a journalist in South Africa black journalist who writes for a major South African newspaper, published a piece citing the Institute for Historical Review and citing me for an article I wrote in 2002, in which we have updated and which is available on our website, about the Jewish lobby in the United States. And he quoted extensively from this. Now, this article that I wrote and the article by the South African journalist, I think, shows and something of the effect and impact that our work has, not just to a small community of people, but around the world and to lots of people, to many, many people beyond our own small circle. And the IHR has a track record of selling and distributing books, leaflets, discs, tapes that's unmatched by any similar group or organization. Every day we send out and distribute books and discs and so forth all across the United States and into foreign countries. No one does as much, I think, to reach especially new people, people around the world, as I do and the Institute for Historical Review does. And I want to make sure that in the this new century and in the years to come, the IHR continues and even more plays a influential and effective role in the world. And we're going to continue doing what we do and do it even better in the years ahead. Now, fortunately, in the last 6 months or so, we've made a number of changes here at the office which have increased our productivity and I think are going to prove even more effective, more productive in the months to come. But we've got to still do a lot more than we have been doing, but it's difficult. We have serious financial difficulties that we have to deal with every month, and the economy being bad doesn't help the situation. But it's absolutely crucial that the IHR, to be effective, to be relevant, to be pertinent in the real world, has to have a focus and work that is related to the world we actually live in and not the one that some people wish we lived in.
Well, this has been a fascinating interview, if I say so myself. Thank you, Mark. And now please tell the listeners how to locate your website on the Internet.
Yes, I urge listeners to check out IHR.org, Institute for Historical Review. I'm the director of the Institute for Historical Review. We've been plugging away at this for quite a few years, but I'm really gratified that a lot of the things that we are saying and have been saying are more accepted and more understood by more people than was true just 5 years or 10 years ago. And anyway, please check out our website, IHR.org.
I want to thank you again, Mark. You have been very generous with your time. And I know I speak for everyone at the network when I say we appreciate all your fine work that you've done throughout the years at the Institute for Historical Review.
Well, thank you, Peter. I appreciate very much your work. And I thank you again for inviting me to be on the show. And I hope I'm on again soon.
Well, Mark, you have an open invitation to appear in my program anytime. Thank you and good day. You have been listening to an interview with Mark Weber from the Institute of Historical Review. Their website is www.ihr.org. Once again, www.ihr.org. Please visit them on a regular basis. They have some fine articles for your perusal. I am Peter Shank, fighting the war of perception on the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network.
Thanks for listening to Shank Talk Worldwide. You are listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Dare to know.